Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Well, earlier this year, Canada announced plans to again delay an expansion to its assisted dying programme for people who have a mental illness. The fresh delay once again put a spotlight on the controversial practice, which was introduced nearly a decade ago. The country now has one of the highest rates of euthanasia in the world, with just over 4% of deaths aided by doctors. And my next guest is a doctor who works in the field of assisted dying in Canada, what's known there as a MAID practitioner. Her name is Dr. Stephanie Green, and she's here now in the studio. Stephanie, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Thank you for being with us. Now, before we hear about the work that you do specifically, will you explain what happened earlier this year when those plans I mentioned to expand assisted dying were put on hold? What happened?
Right. Well, I think the context is important. It's important to know that in Canada, assisted dying came about through our court system. And the original court case didn't actually exclude anyone from access to assisted dying, even those with mental health disorders or any other diagnosis. But the government felt that for certain patients with certain diagnoses, we may not be ready for that. So they, in 2021, they put an exclusion into our law such that if mental health problem was your sole underlying condition, you couldn't access MAID. That exclusion was meant to disappear this year, but the government decided to delay that lifting of the exclusion. So that's been delayed till 2027.
Okay, so that's where things stand now. And before we talk about what you do, you'll understand, given what you've just explained to us, how divisive this issue is. I mean, it's one here in Ireland where people have major concerns about it, and some people even have difficulty discussing it.
Well, I think you've hit on an important point. I think people have difficulty discussing the issue. But I would want to clarify that certainly in Canada, this is not a divisive issue. It can be a controversial issue. It can be an emotional issue. It is very intense and people have strong opinions. But national polls year after year in Canada, before our law changed, every year after it changed, and even after the recent amendment, we see consistently over 80% of the Canadian public supporting assisted dying. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But here we know people have concerns about it. Now, you have always had an interest in the intersection between medical ethics and the law. But
yes.
Before you worked in assisted dying, and this is the fascinating bit, you worked in maternity care.
Yes.
So how did one lead to the other?
Well, it's never a linear path, of course. So I'm 30 years a doctor. I trained as a family physician. I spent most of my career in maternity and newborn care. I felt a certain aging in my body. Being up at night and delivering babies at night, it became more and more difficult to recover from that. I felt the pressure to be home a little bit more often before my children left the home. I was looking for a change. And of course, this court case, this challenge to the banning of assisted dying in Canada was coming through. I've always practiced what I consider patient-centered care, always putting the patient at the center so their needs, their values, and their preferences are what shape our clinical decisions. And assisted dying seemed to really speak to that for me. And so when I saw this law coming into effect, I stepped forward to do the work.
So it was the law then, that the law change that prompted you into this area of assisted dying?
That and the pressure to be home a little bit more instead of in the hospital in the middle of the night.
Okay. And what about the similarities, or what did you draw from your experiences in maternity care that seemed to fit with assisted dying practice?
Yeah, I actually believe my career in maternity care is probably the very best preparation for my work in assisted dying. You know, as a maternity care doctor, people would come to me to be a knowledgeable guide for their transition that's happening in their lives, to help prepare them for this event, to be there with them where they labor and deliver their baby, to be with them on one of the most important days in their life, a day that's full of intensity, a day filled with family dynamics, a day filled with emotion, and an unpredictable but natural event was happening. And of course, to recognize that I was not the most important person in the room, that this was about the family and the couple and the newborn baby. And all of those things could be said to be the same on the day of someone's assisted death. It is certainly one of the most important days in their life. It's certainly a day that's emotional and intense and filled with family dynamics. And I am certainly not the most important person in the room. So there's a skill set to choreographing the event, to being the person with the knowledge and still allowing this natural event to unfold with patients and with their families, and to respect that. And so I think it was the perfect preparation for me to do this work.
So with medical assistance in dying in Canada, what is permitted? What are the rules?
Right. So in Canada, if you want an assisted death, you do need to ask for it. It has to be the patient that asks for it. Nobody else can trigger this for you under any circumstance. There's a rigorous process in place. You have to be assessed by two independent practitioners. We allow medical practitioners and nurse practitioners to do this work. They need to be independent of each other. And then, of course, they need to be deemed eligible. And to be as concise as possible, there's approximately five things that need to be true. The patient certainly needs to be an adult. They need to be over 18 years of age. They need to be eligible for Canadian government-funded healthcare. So you can't come from another country and pay for this. You have to be have legal status within Canada. You have to make a voluntary request. There can be no sense of coercion, and a large part of my job is to make sure that that's true. Patient needs to have the capacity to make this request, meaning they understand what's wrong with them, they understand their treatment options, including palliative care, and knowing full well what this information is, they give informed consent to receive this care. And you have to have what most people get to, the crux of the matter, what our law calls a grievous and irremediable condition, which is further defined as someone who has a serious and incurable illness, disease, or disability, that they find themselves in an advanced state of irreversible decline in function or in capability, and that they're enduring a suffering that they themselves deem intolerable and that cannot be relieved. So all of that needs to be true. Those are the eligibility criteria. But on top of that, there's actually procedural safeguards that also need to be satisfied. And depending on which track, which route you take to an assisted death, there's actually two different tracks. There's different procedural safeguards. Some of them are straightforward, like what you would think, what you would imagine. You need to make a request that's written and signed and dated and witnessed, give consent, not just at the request, but to give consent again, you know, immediately prior to the administration of the medication. These are for people who are what we call, who are dying in a way that we call reasonably foreseeable. You know, the classic case is the person with terminal cancer who's on a trajectory towards death that we can predict. For patients who aren't with terminal illness, who aren't dying in the foreseeable future, we do allow them access to MAID. They have to meet all of those same eligibility criteria and the same procedural safeguards. But there's additional safeguards as well, which makes some sense. And without getting into the weeds about them, that involves more time, a mandatory 90-day assessment. It involves the expertise of someone in the condition for which they're suffering that must be involved in that assessment, making sure they're aware of and have been offered all the reasonably available means to reduce their suffering, and that they've given serious consideration to trialing those options. So it's quite a robust system. Mm-hmm. It's not as simple as some people think.
Okay, a couple of questions arise now from what you've just said. Have you ever come across a case where you suspected somebody might be coerced?
So in my 8 years, I've only come across one case where I actually suspected that. A few where I've wondered it and dug into it, but one case where I actually turned somebody down because I actually felt it to be true. It's not very common. What I find actually much more common, I see patients who have been coerced out of accessing medical assistance and dying due to their family's needs or desires.
Mm-hmm. Because there are those who feel that people who are in this situation, they take the decision, and this is what I read from other jurisdictions, of course, they take the decision because they feel they're going to be a burden on their families.
Yeah, so I actually pop that bubble with patients. Patients will sometimes say to me, you know, like we have a conversation. Who are you? What's important to you? Why are you having this discussion with me? Why now? What has changed? What still brings meaning to your life? And patients will often say, well, I don't want to be a burden on my family. So we'll talk about that. What do you mean by that? What would you do if it was your spouse or your child? Would you be there for them? Would you consider that a burden? We talk that out. And you know, the bottom line is being a burden on your family is not a reason to have an assisted death. As I just went through a very detailed list with you, it's not on that list. So if that is the only motivation for them to have an assisted death, they simply won't qualify.
Yeah, and there are people here who feel very strongly that this shouldn't happen in mm-hmm. Ireland. And they say, invest more in palliative services. Mm-hmm. Give people a more comfortable death when they're facing a difficult situation. Now, you outline that you have to tell people who have made this decision what is available to them. Is there enough available to them if they decide to carry on with their lives?
Well, I think enough is a relative term. I think part of our law explicitly requires us to inform patients about palliative care. And we do a fairly good job with palliative care. Certainly, if you look at the average Canadian who dies, probably less than 50% of them have access to palliative care. But our data shows that 96% of people who have had an assisted death have had access to palliative care, and almost 80% of them are actually receiving it. So we see that palliative care or lack of access to palliative care is certainly not a reason why people are accessing MAID in Canada.
And is investment in palliative care services still happening at the same level that it was before people were permitted to access assisted dying?
Oh, I would say no, it's significantly higher. Like in every jurisdiction that has allowed the legalization of assisted dying, the investment and interest in palliative care in Canada has risen with the legalization of assisted dying. Can we do better? Sure, we can always do better. But that is certainly not the reason people are accessing assisted dying.
And I'm really interested to know what you feel you've learned personally from dealing with people who are going through this. Are there cases that you can talk about in general terms even?
Oh, there's lots of cases. I've written a book. But I think there's a lot. I mean, how could I not be affected by this work? I think the two things I would stress maybe are that I've been fairly overwhelmed by the gratitude expressed by patients and by their families just for the opportunity to have an honest and open conversation about end of life. I mean, traditionally, we're not very good at that conversation. This work allows me to have that conversation, to explore options, to have really very raw and honest conversations about what those options can be. And people are grateful for that. So I think that's one thing. I think also, it's, you know, in Canada, assisted dying, 99% of cases are clinician administered. So it's not done by the patient alone. I'm there in the room administering the medications. So in that very intimate space, in that very privileged position, I hear last words. I see people say goodbye to their spouse of 50 years. I'm witnessing some extraordinary events, and it's impossible for me not to project myself into those situations. And I cannot help but wonder, what would I do in that situation? Who would I want holding my hand? What music would I want be playing? But more importantly, who would I want near me when death is near me? And so it has made me so much more reflective about the people and the relationships in my life. I think it's not only made me a better physician, but I think it's possibly made me a better person. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very grateful for the work. I find it very rewarding work personally, but I find it very rewarding because of all the gratitude that the patients and the families have told me.
What's your memory of the first case that you dealt with?
So I've spoken before about the very first case is a gentleman that I call Harvey. It's not his real name, of course. And Harvey was a remarkable man who was literally waiting for the law to change. He was dying from end-stage liver failure, and he knew that he was going to be dying. He very much wanted an assisted death, and he was literally knocking on the door when this became possible. He had an incredible family. I'm very grateful they were the first family I worked with. Harvey was determined. He was adamant. He knew exactly what he wanted. He was a self-made man who wanted to die on his own terms. He wanted to die in his bed, in his house with his family around him. And we went through the rigorous process of finding him eligible. We had two assessors do that. It did not take too long in his case. He was so ill. And he organized a very an open house where his friends and family and neighbors would come to see him to say goodbye the several days before he had scheduled his death. The day of his actual death was, you know, etched in my mind. That room was just Harvey, his wife of 52 years, his two children, and myself and my nurse. We were all physically touching each other. His children were holding him. His wife was leaning in forehead to forehead. They were whispering to each other as he fell asleep. And he died exactly as he wanted, in the arms of his family, gazing into the eyes of his wife. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly moving, incredibly powerful, and I think a really great example of how this can be as good as it can be, as good as it gets in this awful circumstances of someone dying, and yet still a very beautiful event.
All right. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming in to see us. There are many conversations to be had around this topic here in Ireland. That's Dr. Stephanie Green, and the World Federation of Right to Die Society's annual conference is being hosted by End of Life Ireland. It's happening in Dublin until Saturday. And if anything you heard there has affected you as you have listened, please visit rte.ie/helplines. We'll be right back.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.